Welcome to the MedTech Talk Podcast. This is your host, Jeff Pardo. Today, we welcome one of the most prolific and successful entrepreneurs in the MedTech industry, Amar Sahani. Amar has started numerous companies across device and drug. He is that unique entrepreneur who can make the transition from founder to long-term CEO. He has formed incubators like Focal and Insect, and from there, companies like Confluent, Augmenix, Access Closure, and his latest, Instilla, as well as many, many more. Amar, so excited to have you on this edition of the podcast.
Thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be there.
So one of the things we like to do on the podcast is explore people's roots in the business and just, you know, a little bit more of kind of your story, your backstory, how you, you know, got into medical devices, and be curious, you know, what, tell us a little bit about how you came to this industry.
Sure. No, it went back to my graduate school days, I guess. So I had come from India to do my master's in chemical engineering, and I tried to get into microelectronics space stuff and chemical engineering and industrial polymers, but didn't get my first two choices. So I took a chance on this young professor who was doing work in biodegradable polymers for adhesion prevention following gynecological surgery. So I took that on as my master's project, not knowing much about it, but having some faint interest in medicine and polymers. And that kind of led to my PhD work, which then transitioned to the hydrogels, where sort of our contribution was to come up with materials that actually could be polymerized inside the body. So you actually could do chemistry inside the body. So that was, I guess, our contribution to this field, which has created a whole field of regenerative medicine. And as part and parcel of some of the innovations that we had created over there, we created these light-activated systems that would allow polymerizations to take place very rapidly with minimal heat or any toxic species being formed. So it had a lot of promise. And so we had some venture capitalists approach us. This was the Mayfield Fund out of California. And they wanted to start a company in the Boston area, a company called Focal, and that is how I got my first job. So I moved from Texas, University of Texas, where I was doing my graduate work, to Cambridge, where Focal was being set up, and I was the first employee. So that's how I got my start in medtech.
Terrific. And tell us a little bit about Focal. What were some of the lessons learned as you set up Focal, and how did it inform some of the things going forward?
Yeah, so I was a young graduate student, so by no means a veteran of the medtech world. So I came in as a senior scientist in that role. And I was not the CEO or running the company. The CEO was at that time Mark Levin, who's, as you well know, in the venture capital world, quite a legend, with Third Rock Ventures now. And he was an amazing guy to learn from. I got a lot of good exposure in everything from fundraising to recruiting to facilities, and, you know, really learned a lot in that process, which I probably wouldn't have if I'd gone to a more mature company. It gave me an opportunity to see things take off from the ground up and realize that, you know, many mistakes can be made even by the most veteran people. So the person who has the most kind of passion is the founder or the technology founder. And those folks, if you disincentivize them, then the whole thing falls apart. So if you don't have a solid foundation, you can build everything else around it, but the core technology needs to be solid. If the core is rotten, then everything else kind of, you know, really can't be built up around it. So we went through some trying times at Focal. The first product where I had frankly gotten sidelined, and the industry veterans came in, they said, "We're going to take it from here. Thank you very much." And they went in and did a first trial out in Europe for adhesion prevention following gynecological surgery, and failed miserably. There was no safety issues because the materials were quite safe, but efficacy was not demonstrated. So this led to a kind of a whole spiraling downwards of the company. And then they came to me and said, "Hey, you're the technology guy. What mistake did we make? I mean, what went wrong?" So I did a long analysis and produced a report, which, you know, summary conclusion was you applied it here and it dripped down and you shone a light where the polymer wasn't. So you didn't get any polymer forming. So we learned from those mistakes and I took a small team and we worked hard for a new application, which is in sealing. And we ended up creating the world's first sealant to prevent air leaks following lung surgery. And this time I said, I'm not going to trust that anybody knows what they're doing because we're all kind of muddling through this ourselves. So I was there in every clinical case, every surgery. We had the R&D team extensively involved. And from there to getting FDA approval, the European trials, the US trials, I was involved in everything. Eventually, we took the company public and it went rather well from that standpoint. But I had a diminishing stake, equity stake, and I said, now that my duty has been discharged, it doesn't make sense for me financially to continue on with, you know, less than 0.25% of equity. So I asked them that, you know, if they could license some of the technology out, which they weren't going to use, like in the adhesion prevention area. But they thought about it and said, no, they're not going to do it. So the other thing that I learned from there is that you can't ask somebody to give you something when they already have it. It feels like you're reaching into their pocket and pulling something out. So it's best not to give it to them in the first place and to give them just enough to work with. So these are very fundamental technologies, as you can well imagine. So that led to the catalyst of myself and my partner, Fred Khushravi, who's on the West Coast, getting together and founding Incept. Incept was meant to be a holding company where we would then create operating companies if we have a very fundamental technology in there. And the operating companies would be siloed based on a particular field of use. So the first of which we created was Confluent Surgical, where we focused on surgical sealing and created DuraSeal. And from that platform, we've created many, many companies. Fred has created many companies. I've created many companies. And it's been a great partnership.
That's fascinating. How did you meet Fred?
So Fred actually came to Focal. We had a program there for sort of the before drug-coated stents had come about. We were looking to create coronary artery coatings that would deliver anti-proliferative drugs to following angioplasty to prevent restenosis. So he had come from ACS where he was before this, Guidant, and to come to run this program. So I got to know him. He was, didn't have any kids. I was not even married at that time. So we kind of hit it off, got to know each other pretty well. And then when he left to go to California, when that program kind of got shut down and start up a company called Embolic Protection, when I was thinking about starting Confluent and Incept, I went to him back in California and said, what do you think? You know, what do you think about this technology? And that's kind of when we decided that we're going to work together and found Incept. And from that's how the sort of the partnership came about.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. And coming to, as, you know, more from a scientific background, how challenging was it to now start to handle the business side of it? And of course, everything in terms of the medical regulatory and reimbursement. I mean, how big a challenge was that coming from, you know, from really being a scientist?
So, one thing that I had realized, you have to be aware of what your strengths are, but more so aware of what your weaknesses are. A long time ago, I had realized that I am reasonably intelligent, but my strength lies in breadth and not as much depth. Well, you know, I was reasonably deep. I did get my PhD. But I realized that there are a lot smarter people in terms of chemistry. There are a lot smarter people in mechanical design, etc. But my strength lay in being able to kind of weave these together, to know enough about any particular area, but to get experts who knew more than I did and build a team that way. So along the way, I took an interest in understanding where this chain could kind of fall apart and whether that was regulatory or whether that was commercial or whether that was in clinical trials, and decided that I would learn and teach myself. So just having an active interest, as I advise my high school age kids that, you only need two things in life to succeed: curiosity and diligence. You need to have curiosity, and you need to follow that up with diligence in terms of working hard and understanding it. So I applied that same principle. If I didn't know something, I would ask people. So sort of created my own brand of understanding and knowledge, depending on what was needed, as opposed to siloing myself and saying that I'm a scientist and I'm going to stick to the science part. And you realize then that even rocket science isn't rocket science. It's a question of learning all the steps and asking yourself every day, did you move the ball forward? And if you did, then soon, little by little, consistent progress leads you a long way. So that's kind of how I've charted my course.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Now, I guess maybe diving into some of the specific companies and maybe some, maybe if you could talk about some of the challenges, but also the, you know, what you really figured out at each company, maybe starting with Confluent. What was, because I remember there was an initial application at Confluent, and then you changed courses there.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so when I started Confluent, while I didn't have a non-compete with Focal, I agreed with them that I wouldn't compete with them for 1 year because it just didn't look good that the founder goes out and sets up another sealant company. So for about 2 years, we worked on adhesion prevention, which is what I had originally told them that I wanted to work on. We actually did some clinical trials. We even got a CE mark and commercialized the product in Europe, a product called SprayGel, and had that going for even quite a while. But once I had some, my non-compete period and more was elapsed, I decided I wanted to go back to sealing, surgical sealing. The reason for that and the lesson learned over there is that the more acute the ability to demonstrate efficacy, which means that right before your eyes in a sealing capacity, you've got a leak, cerebrospinal fluid is leaking through the incision, you apply this material, within seconds the leak is gone, you do a Valsalva maneuver, breath hold maneuver that increases pressure, and show that the leak is sealed. It's a very clear proposition for everybody to understand, appreciate, and be willing to pay for. Adhesion prevention can be more challenging, which is that it happens sometime in the post-operative period. And it may or may not result in a clinical complication. So firstly, documenting that something bad happened or that you ended up being able to prevent it or that it resulted in some clinical benefit all become sort of tenuous. So I have tried to pick things, targets, as a result of that learning, which can demonstrate efficacy more acutely. So between Fred and myself, for example, we've created companies that have embolic filters, where mostly Fred has done this work. But, you know, you have a filter, you finish the procedure, you pull the filter out, and there's gunk in there. And you know that you did something, right? Same thing goes with femoral puncture closure and access closure, where you would otherwise have a hematoma that would grow in the groin, and you sealed it, and a few minutes later, you're done. So as a result of these things, you're not able to, you can demonstrate efficacy very, very quickly and clearly. While if you have something that only shows efficacy and quality of life improvement 1 year later or 3 years later, becomes a much more difficult proposition. So selecting clinical indications to work on, in this case, was pretty important.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it like that. And I'd be interested to know kind of how your board reacted at Confluent. You know, sometimes as investors, you know, we obviously were going in thinking it's going a certain way, and then changing course to a very different application can be difficult for people to wrap their minds around, even if it's exactly the right decision.
I think you're talking about our mutual friend Dan Cole.
Exactly.
where when I came in and said I want to do surgical sealants, he looks at me and saying, "What is a surgical sealant?" and he said, "I signed up for adhesion prevention. What do you mean you're going to do surgical sealing?" So then I went out and explained to him, he gradually got to appreciate it, and I think was thankful we did go down that particular pathway. So I think, you know, even initially, when we were starting the company, the structure that we had of INSEP holding the intellectual property and the intellectual property not being in the company itself was something which was harder for people to understand, for the venture capitalist who was investing in it to understand, that this wasn't some kind of a racket, that I would turn around 3 months after the investment and saying, oh, by the way, we need this and this and this also, and now you're going to have to pay for it. And that would be, you know, put people in a very difficult situation. So there was some concern on that. In fact, there's a case that the Harvard Business School wrote up on it, which is taught at HBS, about sort of this somewhat of a standoff between myself and Charles Warden from SV Life Sciences. There wasn't any standoff. You know, they always try to make it more sensational than actually things were. But it was a discussion topic for sure. Mm-hmm. As to, because this was not a structure which was conventional, where intellectual property would all be within the company. So I think that brought about some questions. But, you know, we displayed good faith in being able to bring in a field without asking for any additional consideration of surgical sealing into the company. And I think the fact that we did that and took out some of the fields that we weren't going to use, it built a good partnership between myself, you know, Incept, and the venture investors. And we ended up having some of these investors be sequential investors in some of the other companies, because they then realized the power of this model, wherein you now have a proven technology. So the next company and the next company you go to create, you've already understood a lot of the manufacturing, all the design considerations, the suppliers, the various types of providers, et cetera. And so it can streamline how you move forward. And you've got a bunch of issued IP and not just filed IP by that point in time. So, and you end up having to spend less, because now multiple licensees are sharing the costs of prosecution. So it created a more powerful engine for medical innovation. But initially, when you're doing it for the first time, you know, both the investors before they were board members and after they were board members had to kind of be walked through a little bit with what we were trying to achieve.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Thanks for tuning in to this podcast. If you enjoy these types of conversations and perspectives, then we, as the podcast producer, encourage you to check out the related MedTech MVP conference at medtechconference.com. For 10% off the conference registration, please use the discount code podcast1.
And now, since Confluent, I mean, you've started a number of companies. You've had a number of successes: Augmenix, Access Closure, your latest in Stilla, and been involved in a number of others as well. Can you talk a little bit about your process for, when, you know, as you've started these companies, how do you go about finding the, you know, the right application? I mean, Augmenix is interesting to me. It wouldn't be obvious to me as kind of a natural fit, but yeah.
Not at all. Meaning, if you'd ask me, what did I know about radiation oncology? I would say absolutely nothing. So how did we end up starting a company in radiation oncology? So in what happened specifically in Augmenix's case, and then we'll talk more about generalities. Specifically in Augmenix's case, what happened is it was somewhat fortuitous. There was this clinician, radiation oncologist out in North Dakota, of all places. And he had noticed that his more obese patients tended to do better after radiotherapy than the thinner patients. Now, you know, all of us in medical devices have an axiomatic feeling that obese patients, obesity is a risk factor, won't do well, et cetera, right? I mean, so we expect the patient who is obese not to do well. But in this case, paradoxically, the obese patients are doing better. So he started thinking as to what was going on, because what happens in prostate cancer radiotherapy is that the prostate lies right next to the rectum. And when you are trying to irradiate the prostate, you end up with a dose expansion that you have a region around it, maybe a few millimeters, maybe half a centimeter, that has to be irradiated so in a broader pattern, so that when the patient is breathing or urine is filling or emptying, you don't end up having some of the cancer go outside of the radiotherapy zone. So to ensure that you're going to get radiation delivered, you expand that beam. But in that expanding of that beam, the rectum comes into the field and gets traumatized and injured, and then patients can end up with lose motions 5 times a day for the rest of their lives, or impotence, or all kinds of other burning while urination, side effects of different types. So this was the problem. And when he saw that these obese patients are doing better, he was wondering why. And he came to the conclusion that the perirectal fat that they had seemed to be helping space the prostate away from the rectum, so that less radiation was getting to the rectum ultimately. So he wondered if he could give everybody some synthetic fat, then maybe everybody could do better. So he started that investigation by taking some of these dermal augmentation collagen, injectable collagen, sort of made a string of pearls because they only came in 1cc syringes, and injected 10 of them in about a series of 10 patients. So he used up like 100 syringes in that process. And they did better. The radiation was better. The side effects were better. And he then wanted to see if he could develop this further. So he went to the company selling that product, but they looked at him sideways and said, "We don't understand what you're doing. You're not supposed to be injecting it there. Go away." So then he went to his intellectual property lawyer, who actually happened to be my intellectual property lawyer also, and who I had gone to graduate school with in chemical engineering. So this gentleman, Curtis Herbert, said, "You know, there's a group that he knows, that which is us, that has better biomaterials technology, and maybe he should talk to us." So that's how we got introduced to him. And I wasn't sure about this application either. So I had a friend of mine who was planning on leaving Boston Scientific. He ran their preclinical department. And I asked him, saying, "You know, you've been wanting to go and do something in a smaller company. This looks interesting, but I don't know if it's for real. Can you go chase this down for 6 months and see if this thing is for real?" So he spent 6 months and he came back saying, "You know what, based on the feedback that I'm getting, this thing seems pretty real." So I said, "Okay, if it seems pretty real and you've objectively taken a look at it, let's go ahead and get started." So we then funded it a little bit. And, eventually we were able to do it much more capital efficiently and barely spent like $45 million in the whole PMA process and reimbursement and Japanese approval and US approval and CE mark and whatnot. And it became a gangbuster of a success. So we realized also that in this journey, that you not only needed to demonstrate that you could decrease the radiation impinging on the rectum, but you had to also show some clinical utility and benefit. So we tracked these patients for 3 years, 5 years, and long-term outcome data showed that their quality of life was much improved, published this stuff in health economic outcome research journals, showed that the quality of life years are more than adequate to pay for this product, even if it's priced at an attractive price for the company. And it becomes a win-win proposition. We've managed to get reimbursement for the clinicians to be able to place this product, and so that they would be interested in placing it. Otherwise, the urologists used to wonder, saying, "Why would I even do this procedure? Because I'm not making any money on it." So looking at all of that stuff that had to come together, from the clinical evidence to the follow-ups, the health economic outcomes, reimbursement, approvals globally, building a direct sales organization, clinical specialists, training programs. So we really went far and deep. We were profitable at the time that Boston Scientific came in and acquired the company. It was a successful exit for us for sure, but I think some of the folks at Boston Scientific later told me this was one of the probably the best acquisition they have ever done. And today it continues to power Boston Scientific sales very well. And they highlight it on their regular industry calls, et cetera. So it's really turned out to be a win-win all around.
Yeah, it's a terrific story. I'd be curious. I mean, this sale happened, right as, we were starting to see a flurry of IPOs in the space. How tempted were you to have this as a standalone company, or did you feel that it was really just better off in the portfolio of a bigger company? How'd you think about that?
Yeah, I think we actually didn't need to go public because I wasn't sure what we would do with all the money. Because remember, we were profitable. We still had money in the bank and we were profitable at the time that the company was sold. So I have a very disciplined approach, meaning maybe it's kind of old school, but I simply don't understand medtech companies that may have 100 million, 200 million in sales and are still losing money. I just don't get it. Maybe I'm like, I'll be stoned out when I step outside my house now at a medtech conference. But I feel that, you know, if a company is doing 30, 40, 50 million in sales, it better be profitable.
Yeah.
So we were quite profitable. We had 96% gross margins, meaning it was like wildly profitable. So in fact, when we ran the numbers at $100 million in sales, it was looking like we would be have a net earnings of $40 million. And it, since we weren't finance guys, we didn't even have a real CFO. People, we wondered if people would look at us and saying, are you guys, you know, do you know how to run spreadsheets and stuff? Because nobody has that. So with that type of economics and no competition and wild growth taking place, we didn't need to do anything. We just needed to run the company. For good or bad, one of the companies that had been following us lobbed in an offer when, you know, I was telling them, hey, please don't send anything across. But they said, no, there's an offer coming in the mail and please respond to it. So I had to take it to the to our board, and you know, it was a decent offer, and we had mentally set a threshold saying if something comes in like around $375 million, then we'll consider it. So they considered it, and then you know, bankers came in, and there were already 3-4 companies circling around, and ended up in this auction process where Boston ended up prevailing. So all in all, I think it was fine. We really could have, if we had run it a couple of years more, probably would have been worth 3 to 4 times that. So, but I did not want to go public. I think the public offering process isn't really a liquidity event for folks. And it can be too distracting in terms of what you need to get done. If you need the capital, like in, you know, I founded Ocular Therapeutics. And in a pharma company, you need a lot of capital. MedTech, not so much, meaning you can actually make these things profitable. So for a pharma company, you do have to go public. You do have to have access to the capital markets, the pipelines, you know, drug products take a lot of money to gain, you know, approval, and the trials are really expensive. So over there, maybe it makes sense to continue to examine the public markets. For MedTech, you know, my feeling is that if you run a disciplined ship, and the private markets are actually getting quite robust. In fact, my partner Fred just completed the largest medical device financing, private financing, with a $260 million fundraise for Imperative Care. So clearly, large funding things can be done now in the private market. So I think I didn't ever want to go public for Augmenix. But we could have probably gone a little longer than we did.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, as I've talked to entrepreneurs, if they have any regret, I mean, obviously it's hugely successful outcome, but it was people who've seen, you know, similar successes, if they have any regret, it's that they sold it too soon. I wonder, is that, does that inform how you think about things with, say, your Instilla, your current company? Or do you just look at it sort of case by case?
I think to some extent it has to be looked at case by case. But I think what I'm sort of having a clear separation in my mind about companies that are single double type of companies and companies that are home run type of companies. So if you have a single double type of a company, then, you know, a strategic exit makes sense. So there are some things that we are doing, for example, in my current efforts, wherein, you know, we're creating some sealants where some of the IP has expired. And those can be, you know, going into established markets. There are players who would and could benefit from those. So I think those are singles, doubles better done for strategic exits. But there are companies that are kind of really cornering off large spaces. And for those with, you know, a large TAM that exists, growth that is sort of, you know, not constrained, it makes sense to, you know, play the long game. See, what happens is oftentimes an entrepreneur who's there has a desire to cash out and, you know, get their win notch and stuff like that, et cetera, build their reputation. So for good or bad, you know, we... Fred and myself, we've had many exits. We don't frankly need the money. So there is no reason for us to get antsy about, taking the money and exiting. Because reality is you take the money and exit, and then you wonder what you're going to do with the money. You look around for propositions like you already had yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And you can't find those investments anymore because they all have risk. At least you know your own investments. So we've come to the conclusion that playing the long game, and that's where Imperative Care is playing the long game. I have another company in the analytics space where I'm on the board. And my cousin runs that company called Axtria. And Axtria just raised $150 million round with Bain Capital. Again, Axtria is profitable, has had $50 million in the bank already, didn't need the money. But, you know, we could accelerate the growth. We could do more product building and stuff like that. And Bain came to us and gave us a very good valuation. So we did it. And that, again, we want to play the long game because we've got 3,000 employees right now. We think we can take that to 10,000 and take that to, you know, multi-billion-dollar company easily. So in that case, again, we're okay with playing the long game. While that same team had earlier sold their company for $160 million to Cognizant some time ago. So now we're kind of going for a 10x on or more on the prior company. So that's sort of the game that we are playing. Same thing with Fred, where, Access Closure was a $350 million acquisition. There's no reason why we can't take Imperative Care into a 10x of that. So we're kind of looking that way. So with regards to Instilla, I think it's a little early to tell, but I think if you do create an embolic, which is seamlessly able to replace a variety of things, whether they are coils and beads and, you know, all kinds of occluders of various sort with a single product, you can really kind of, that's the beauty of these in situ form materials, that you can really customize it while providing a standard offering, product offering, customize it at the site of delivery. And that can create a pretty powerful proposition. So remains to be seen. We want to approach this humbly. I think the point is, until you have your first approval, and until you've sort of, you know, really demonstrated to people that you're for real, it's hard to go ahead and pound your chest and stuff. And I don't want us to do that and let things get ahead of ourselves, because sometimes entrepreneurs can end up drinking way too much of their own Kool-Aid and gain an arrogance in this process. I want us to kind of approach this humbly and deliver value. And then comes the time to kind of go around and sizzle and stuff like that. But right now, we just keep our head down and deliver the milestones that we've told our investors and board members that we're going to produce. And we'll see. But my point is that we have created this type of company now to be able to run the long game and not be driven by exits to strategics in the near term. There's no reason why we cannot be the strategics of choice.
Yeah, having that sort of optionality and just control over your destiny is—it's a real advantage. One of the things that fascinates me is, you know, being where we are in the Northeast, which is, you know, obviously a haven of biotech and medtech, but definitely one of the havens of biotech, and platforms, you know, are really the norm in biotech. Whereas, as you've described in medical devices, you know, you've made the decision to be really focused, you know, divide up the platform into really targeted applications. Why is that? Why doesn't a platform approach work in the device world, whereas it seems to be the norm in biotech?
So I think, you know, one other thing is, it's a question of whether the platform is a real platform or not a real platform. Everybody likes to use the term platform. For a drug company, a particular enzyme or a mechanism or something can constitute a platform for them. Yes, it's a platform, but it's not as broad a platform. And then they will slap it on whatever, because the PK studies and the systemic studies that are to be done have a commonality to them. So it makes sense to then investigate it broadly. And if it works, then that's great. And any one of those business opportunities can end up becoming, you know, a billion-dollar molecule for them. So expending the dollars simultaneously to investigate and throw out these multiple grappling hooks makes a ton of sense. In the medtech world, this optionality is not rewarded as well. What we find is, meaning, I remember this one conversation I had when with one of the largest medtech players at Confluent, and where I was pointing out that, yes, we have the dural sealant, but we could make lung sealants, we could make bowel sealants and stuff like that. And they said, well, that sounds great and stuff like that. And I said, well, here's sort of the P&L for this product and here's the P&L for these other things and stuff. They said, whoa, wait a minute. We're buying this product. I said, yeah, but you know, what about all this other stuff? They said, well, that's our upside. That's not your upside. So I said, wait a minute. So all this optionality that I'm producing has no reward, has no upside to it. So I think unlike in a pharma world, people will actually reward you for that and pay for it. MedTech only rewards for what is real, what seems to be. So at least that's what my experience has been. I'm sure some people would differ on that, but my take has been that I've never gotten rewarded for the pipeline as much, as one can in the biotech world. And biotech acquisitions can take place specifically for the pipeline, with disregard for what the current molecule, the commercial molecule might be. So, I think that's a difference over here, and I find that we also learn a lot and from the platform execution where we've executed on one area. And we've had a ton of learnings. And when we apply it the next time and the next time, it creates a competitive edge for us. So we can actually execute faster. We can be diluted less. And the proposition improved for the investors, et cetera. And we also have then been able to feel out who are the right employees, who are the right people to work with, who are the right investors. So the journey becomes also more pleasurable and smooth each time we go further. So without the baggage of the earlier mistakes, so you're not dragging any corpses along in that process, either on your cap table or, otherwise from whether on the board or whatever else. So you essentially start anew and you learn from all your mistakes and so the journey at Augmenix couldn't have been more perfect for that matter. We had no wasted stock. All the right people did well. There were nobody who was complaining at the end of it, unhappy about things. So for me, a very, very satisfactory outcome where patients, employees, the acquirer, doctors, everybody did well. So when you have that kind of an experience, I would say, that is the optimal to strive for. And very hard to be able to pull that off the first time around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. And maybe getting into that a little bit, just the lessons in leadership that you've been able to take away, because you're one of the rare people that's able to both found these companies and then be the long-term CEO. How much of a learning process was that for you? Did you sort of just naturally gravitate to, being able to make that transition, or was it any painful experiences in that kind of evolution?
Yeah, so you have to look at it. I look back when I was 31 years old at leaving Focal, going to Confluent, trying to raise money, and your earlier fund spray and SVE Life Sciences gave me $5-6 million of investment to a 31-year-old kid. Meaning, who does that kind of a thing? At that time, especially, that was a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So I think back to that, and this question was asked by them. As they said, "Are you the right guy to run this thing?" And I didn't get offended by that because it was a legitimate question, which is that I had no track record of being a CEO. I had only been a scientist, and here I was asking them for this chance. So there was some question. So my response to them was, I don't know if I'm the right guy, but I tell you that I am the most motivated guy, the most passionate guy, and I'll work hard. And I'll tell you this, that if I find that my growth is constraining the company's growth, I'll step out of the way. So I said, that is my implicit contract with you, that if I find myself, however, that doesn't automatically mean that I should be sidelined right from the outset because I don't have this experience. So we should, let's evaluate it as it goes by. And as it happened, you know, I managed to learn at a clip which outpaced the needs of the company, and where it was able to build a good team. And in the team also, the question of sort of who to hire, how to hire, I took some chances. I took some chances on individuals who had been let go by a large company. But then after I dug into it, I realized that they had been made into a scapegoat and they were actually good. And when you sort of pick up and embrace those types of folks, they have a sense of loyalty to you. And, you know, 25 years later, I still work with many of them. So we kind of went out, and sometimes I would ask people, who's the best person that you have ever worked for? And they would identify a certain individual, and whether or not that role was open within the company, we would try to find a way to bring those people in. So that, whether it's for myself or whether it is for the leadership team, this is how we kind of went about building it. Now, there was an occasion, and this happened at Ocular Therapeutics. Being a pharma company, the quality systems in a pharma company, in manufacturing in a pharma company, is very different than that of medtech. As much as we medtech guys would like to think that's the same, it's not. The stringency by the FDA, the separation of quality and manufacturing, a lot of it is very, very different. And I didn't actually appreciate that fully. So we got dinged a couple of times. We had what's called a CRL, or a complete response letters, because of some manufacturing issues, not because the product didn't work, but because some manufacturing issues, there were some particulates and stuff. I've never been through a more stressful time in my life. And after going through it a couple of times, I then realized, saying, you know what, the problem is not the company or the technology. The problem may actually be me, wherein I don't have that competence of what they're looking for in this. And probably I am not going to ever go out and educate myself, or I'll become a bottleneck. There are other people who know this stuff. So I went to the board at that time and said, I would like to submit that we need to recruit a new CEO. And they said, no, let's just get in the president, and we'll have you be the CEO and let that person grow. And I said, no, if you want to get a good quality person, we need to look at it saying the CEO role can be available. You can start looking for presidents, but if you find a great guy and he needs to be the CEO, you'll be the CEO and I'll step away and be the executive chairman. So we did that transition, and Ocular has thrived with Anthony Matisich, who we brought in, who used to run one of the, you know, Mundipharma, one of the largest European pharma companies. And it's been great sailing ever since. So I think realizing where your strengths lie, where your weaknesses lie, being a little aware of that is kind of important.
Yeah, that capacity for self-reflection, self-awareness, I mean, it's incredibly important. The curious, just something you said around hiring and really building these A-plus teams. Tell me a little bit about your process. Are there a set of qualities that you're looking for as you look to bring in people around you? Or again, is it kind of case by case?
Well, I think it depends case by case, but for sure, meaning many times we are able to sort of repurpose our folks who have worked with us in prior companies, and they have gone and spent time with the larger companies, but clearly are itching to kind of do something new. So there's always a kind of a stable of folks, so to speak, that we can tap into. And since these folks have had a great experience with us, they're always open to working again and kind of joining the team again. So there's always that group that is out there. And I feel that a circle of connects good people. So if you find one really good person, you have to kind of ask them if they know other good people, or people that you respect in the industry who know some of the best people. So I think those good people are sort of connected by this. The other process that I tend to look at is, everybody can make a mistake once. Some can even make it twice. So when I look at a resume and there is one failure, two failures, that's okay if they've got explainable reasons. But if there's three, sort of like the baseball rule, I find that it's not, you know, the world's not against them. It's them. They are the problem. And you got to move on. Because you'll find that they'll continue to have some explainable reason why they're failing. There's a million ways to fail. And failure is part of the process. But there is few ways to succeed. And the people who know how to succeed have somehow figured out how to turn failure into success. Their tenacity, their intellectual prowess, or whatever it is, they've got a formula on learning how to succeed. So you got to find people who have at least sometimes succeeded, so they know what success looks like. If you get somebody who's only failed, they may have success staring at them in the face, but they don't know how to take that shot. So I think those things we tend to sort of, at least I tend to look for in this. And I would hire attitude over resume in that regard. So if somebody has a great attitude of wanting to learn, wanting to do the right thing, is a good people person, can build teams. If they haven't worked specifically in this particular area or that particular area, I'm a little bit more open to being look past that.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting approach and makes a lot of sense. You know, in our current sort of day and age, there's increasing importance and emphasis on having diverse teams, both in terms of gender diversity, and not as much yet, but I think we eventually will also start placing more emphasis on racial diversity. And, you know, you look around our industry and it's a relatively male dominated industry. I'm curious to get your thoughts here, you know, both on sort of the importance of diversity, but also how do we sort of manage this current day and age that we're in, such that you're not overemphasizing identity versus sort of competence, and not that you would have to achieve these objectives, but it is a worry of mine that is probably easy for me to say, being a white male, but it is a worry of mine as we sort of get deeper into this that we're starting to overemphasize, you know, someone's identity as opposed to their skill set, and so how do we avoid kind of that trap and yet still open the doors and make sure that we have, you know, very inclusive environments?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there is a formulaic answer to that, but what I have found is that if we organically give people a chance and don't automatically assume. I look at it as the same lesson applied to me, right? Here was this 30, 31-year-old young guy wearing a turban coming out. If you're a older white male, and you look at that and saying, who is this guy? what rock did he crawl out from, and why should I kind of make him the CEO and give him money? So I think the point has to be, well, let's give him a chance and hold him to a certain standard, not an outrageous standard that is different for really applied for other people. But let's try to look past that and see if he performs. And I think I would say the same thing for gender diversity or racial diversity or other things also, is that let's not let our inherent biases that may be there. And biases, nobody likes to think that they're biased, but all of us are biased in one way or the other. It's just the human way of making sense of the world, is that you have a pattern that you try to recognize and you fit things to that. But I would say that we need to consciously make sure that we're not, letting that bias prevent us from giving people a particular chance. And if you start that from the leadership standpoint on the management team, and if you start opening up to the leadership in that regard and bringing in people who are diverse, whether it is gender diversity or other diversity, you find that those people, one, take their role very seriously, and they'll work extra hard to discharge their duty, not because you're asking them to, but because they actually want to. And they set a role model. They will hire additional people who will, you know, fulfill that mission also. And soon you realize that you have ended up creating a more diverse workplace where there is respect. So sometimes people ask me the question of sort of, you know, what would you rather take? Would you take loyalty or would you take competence? You see, so sometimes leaders will want unquestionable loyalty. My feeling is that's a mistake. What you want is competence. Once you have competence, there is respect for that individual within the team because they are really competent at something that they do. And from that respect comes cohesion within the team. And that's the type of culture that we'd like to build. And if you do that, then these differences of whether it is, you know, gender or racial differences tend to kind of fall away. And you've truly created a diverse workplace because you have kind of relied on competence as the cornerstone of the building that you're going to live in. So in this regard, for example, at Instilla, we are about 65% women. And our management team is more than half women. Our board is 50% women. So, and with, you know, diverse representation in that regard. So we've been able to kind of, you know, walk the walk. And the same thing was true at Obmenix to a large extent. And we are trying to do that in whichever companies that we end up creating. And if that means that we need to promote somebody who may not be getting full recognition, but is really competent and give them a little bit of a break to get them up, and then let's do that.
Yeah. That's so interesting. And I think, you know, of course, it makes sense. I mean, there's, you know, a fairness aspect to it, making sure that the, you know, you're really having sort of inclusive hiring processes and really selecting the best person, no matter man, woman, ethnicity. There is this notion, though, also that, that, you know, diverse teams function better. And I think I understand that, but to me that gets to diversity of thought in addition to diversity of whatever your identity is. And I wonder if that's conflated at all, whether, you know, just because you're from a certain background doesn't mean you necessarily think diversely, or am I wrong about that? Do you find that having a more diverse workforce, you're naturally getting sort of a diversity of thought process?
Yeah, that's a good point. When I tend to sort of, I sometimes give talks at schools and universities about this, about entrepreneurship. And my point is that don't hire everybody in your own image. As much as we all kind of tend to love each other and think we're the best that there ever was created, if you keep hiring people who just are completely loyal to you and are clones of you, meaning it's like, you know, binging only on carbohydrates or something like that, and you have an imbalanced diet. You need to have people who have aligned values, but varying skill sets and varying kind of ways of thinking, because that's what we'll give. So values are constant. They should all be the true north. We should all be working towards the same set of values. And it's very important to dictate what your corporate values are and sort of have agreement on that. So we sort of do a team exercise and decide what our values are going to be and lay them down. And then we pick people for their specific competence and diversity. And we create a culture where, and explicitly state this, that anybody can ask any question of a team member or leadership. And we should have the ability to either have a logical answer to that or be open to, you know, debate and discussion and changing of our position if we don't have a good answer to that. So this, instead of having unquestionable kind of, you know, top-down loyalty and based on sort of, you know, title that you, just because I said so, that doesn't fly anymore. So I think when you have that type of a culture, automatically people are not afraid to speak up because they know they will not be penalized or for it. They are not afraid to fail in a controlled fashion. So make your mistakes, you know, early and originally type of a thing. So that type of a culture, once it is there, then there is diversity of thought. And it sort of comes about where people are not afraid because the thoughts exist. It's just, do you allow them to emerge or not?
Yeah. I think that's really a great way to describe it. We're running out of time here, but there's a couple other topics I wanted to touch on with you. And one is kind of the med tech ecosystem on the West Coast and the East Coast. And again, you're in a unique position where you've really seen it play out on both coasts. And, you know, I think as you've described it to me, that there really is a difference in kind of the cultures and how we approach things on either coast. What are your thoughts there? What are the differences, I guess, both pro and con, and being on the East Coast? How do you deal with those pros and cons?
So yeah, I think firstly, my view is that anything that is a perceived disadvantage is a double-edged, or a two-sided coin. Being eternally optimistic, I've always tried to turn whatever is there into an advantage as opposed to perceiving it as a disadvantage. So with that as a backdrop, I do feel that, the kind of the pilgrim attitude still persists out on the East Coast a little bit, at least on the medtech sector. I can't say the same thing in the biotech sector. I think the biotech sector has loosened up a lot more in that regard. But the medtech sector, I think, does approach things a little bit more conservatively. In general, medtech is more conservative than biotech. And on the East Coast, medtech is a little bit further conservative. On the West Coast, I think people are willing to swing a little bit more for the fences, try out more crazy ideas kind of a thing, and try out more paradigm shifting types of ideas as opposed to incremental type of things. So I do see that. Now, of course, there are exceptions that will be there. And if I ever say that in public, there'll be five guys that will point out all the places where I'm wrong about it. But I think in a broad sense, I do see that type of a difference exists. It probably exists because the funders and the people who kind of are willing to take risk are also somewhat more disproportionate. So they're able to feed these types of ventures. It may not be that the ideas don't exist on the East Coast in that regard. It's a question of where do those ideas find the nutrition that they need to flourish, and whether it was, not that Facebook is any of God's contribution to mankind kind of a thing, but it sort of exemplifies what happened, that those ideas had to go out west to be nurtured and grow. So I think some of that we do see. However, there are always exceptions to that. I wouldn't discourage anybody at the East Coast that they have to go west to build it. I think nowadays you can do it in either of these places.
And one thing I think we both see is that there is sort of I think on the East Coast, it is maybe a more thrifty culture here. I mean, I think you talked earlier about doing things in a more cash efficient way. And of course, I think you can see examples on both coasts where that happens. But that has been a little bit more my experience too, is that there is more, leaner operations and maybe a bigger willingness to swing for the fences and have the dollars correspond with that.
Yeah.
In the West Coast.
No, I mean, I sometimes wonder about myself in that regard. I mean, I just had one of our investors last week. I was talking to them. And they just had a big liquidity event out in India where some of their 5G network companies got bought out and stuff, and they've got a bunch of money sloshing around. And they said, "Do you need any money?" I said, "No, I don't need any money." I said, "Well, you should take some money." I said, "Well, I don't want any money," kind of a thing. So it's kind of an odd discussion where the investor is thrusting money upon you and you're saying, "Please, please don't give me any money," kind of a thing. I don't think in the West Coast that would happen. Probably people will say, "Well, let's find a way to take your money," kind of a thing. So I feel that once you have the money, you find ways to spend it and you get bad habits, so to speak, where you either buildings or programs that otherwise shouldn't get funded and stuff like that. So some fiscal discipline is necessary, but sometimes, you realize that you may be missing out on some big things because you're doing incremental thinking. So I do suffer from that myself a little bit, I think. This is where my partner, Fred, on the West Coast kind of, brings that element of, he's Kurdish. He took risks. He was in the revolution when he got kicked out of Iran. He was dancing on top of tanks and stuff. I probably would not have done that either. So So it's a good partnership in that regard. We keep each other, motivated and honest.
Now it gets to the back to the topic of having some diversity of thought and being able to counterbalance.
Absolutely. He's West Coast, East Coast. I'm East Coast. He's mechanical. I'm chemical. He's a lot more polished human being. I'm sort of I always feel I'm chasing after diamond in the rough type of things, and I am sort of rough around the edges. So yeah, but I think, we get along famously.
Yeah, that's terrific. And last topic, was something that I think you don't really struggle with, given all your successes, but I'm curious to get your perspective on it, is, a funding gap that we're seeing for early stage companies and first time entrepreneurs really trying to get that initial round of funding. The Sprays of the world are now far and few between. Well, how do you advise people who are getting started? Where should they turn for money, and how do we address this as an industry?
Yeah, no, I think that is a good point. The classic sort of, seed venture funds and stuff are fewer and far between. Everybody wants to invest in growth capital when you've gotten your approval and all the regulatory risk has been taken out and you're just doing market expansion. Well, who wouldn't kind of want to be the last money in and get, within a year, 3x kind of a thing. But these technologies need to be nurtured, and earlier stage investment is required. As you mentioned, it's not as much of an issue for us because A, of our track record, and B, our own ability to write checks. So I think when I advise younger entrepreneurs or academics who are looking to spin companies out, obviously there are non-dilutive sources of capital available from various grants and funding organizations. And sometimes you can rely on that, like, there was a company, Alidea Health, which recently got acquired, and Alidea, I'd been talking to them about a board position, and they had some good, non-dilutive sources of capital that had contributed to that. The other is to the angel groups have actually gotten more organized and stuff like that, and there are now a lot more angel groups out over there. Finally, family offices tend to sort of fill a lot of that niche, which is the Series B financing types of things, where there are even people who are aggregators of family offices who can be approached. And we used to actually go to some of these guys even as a public company. I remember out in New York, there's a guy who was Russian family offices in the diamond business, wanted to sort of diversify out into biotech and medtech. So it's like a niche for everything, I guess. There are people of that sort and family offices of that sort. So we have had good success with Desh Pandey, who's in the tech world, but they have a family office and they invest in all of our deals, and we have a great partnership in that regard. So I would say that, look around for those types of things, because people want to kind of diversify. And sometimes there are particular patient advocacy groups and stuff that can be good sources for that. So if you're working on an indication that may have affected somebody personally, then people sometimes have a soft corner for those types of things too. Finally, there are hospitals, meaning there are, like Cleveland Clinic has a venture group, and partners of the venture group and stuff like that. So if they see the value, and Kaiser Permanente has one, if they see the value that something economic that you're going to be improving and the care continuum that you're going to be improving, then you can look towards them for investments, as you can with sometimes physicians. If you're really doing the early stage seed work, then physicians can sometimes be a good source of investment. And we've done that at Confluent, where we had some of the neurosurgeons initially invest in the company.
That's great advice. Well, Mark, can't thank you enough for taking the time today. It's been fascinating. I wish we had another hour to go through all these different things, and I've learned a ton just listening to you. So really appreciate it.
No, it's entirely my pleasure.